Shut up and sit down.
Welcome to the Health and Wealth Podcast with your hosts, Tim and Carter.
What's trending in Richards? Carter Wilcoxon, founder of CSI Financial Group here with my co-host and former wealth advisor, Tim James, founder of
ChemicalFreeBody.com and your new health advisor. This is the show where we reveal the connection between physical and financial abundance.
Hey, welcome back in Richards. Carter Wilcoxon coming to you a little bit sunburnt. I got a chance to go visit family this weekend. We went out to Mojave Valley. For those of you in Richards who don't know where Mojave Valley is, it's on the Colorado River, right in between the tri-state area, California, Nevada, Arizona. So anyway, drove out there, Bullhead City, Laughlin area is where it's at. So I got a little sunburnt, and I was going to ask something about that, Tim, about, you know, what should I do, aloe vera and thing, because I was really nervous because of all the things I've learned on this show. But speaking of Tim, I want to go ahead and bring in my co-host, Mr. Chemical Free Body himself, Tim James. Timmy, how are you, buddy?
Hey, dude, doing good, doing good. Yeah, you were right on the money there with the aloe. You just got to get the right kind of aloe. I mean, all of it kind of works at some level, but a lot of these companies dilute it down. It's just so powerful. You think about it, even Western medicine, who, you know, they really do a good job in crisis care. They really fail in, you know, chronic care. They use aloe for burn victims in hospitals because of how effective it is. Right. So it's something that's accepted by both, you know, traditional type of medicine and the new age, you know, crisis care management, Western medicine.
Yeah.
So you got to get some aloe on your body.
Well, so I was nervous though, because my wife went to go get the stuff at the grocery store and she brought back, you know, it was like Vaseline brand or whatever, and aloe vera. And, you know, you got me so paranoid about putting anything on my skin that I put it on and it soothed it and everything. But then after I started reapplying, I was like, man, I wonder, because I don't know what to look for ingredients on that. But I know aloe vera is typically, anyway, it's been accepted the worldwide, you know, from everybody. So at least I was on the right track.
That's right. You were.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Well, hey, and Richards, we are very excited about our guest today. And we had a little small technical difficulty coming in here. So that just tells me it must be worth the wait for us, because it definitely took a little bit of, you know, some IT figuring out. I think we'll talk about that at some point during this podcast. But I want to go ahead and bring in our guest, Paul Nicolai of Asperience Financial. I'm pretty sure I'm saying that correctly. Mm-hmm. So, Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's real great to be here. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for, you know, being patient, getting onto the show and everything. I know we spoke, you know, a few weeks back, mm-hmm. on having you come on to be a guest and everything. And after talking with you, I'm like, man, I can't wait to get Paul onto the show. Just from some of the things you were sharing with me, you know, your background and your experience and stuff of that nature. But anyway, we really do appreciate you coming on the show today.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So as is, you know, traditional in Richards, what we like to do is we like to give the backstory. Like, well, what was it that brought Paul into the financial services business? You know, typically that's a mentality of trying to want to, you know, help people. You know, that's just your mentality. It's just your personality, really. So, Paul, let's go back into your journey into the financial services business. And what was it, you know, early on, maybe some influencers, or when did you start recognizing that maybe financial services was sort of, you know, the thing for you, if you can remember going back as far as you can, and then ultimately we'll get to your journey and where you're at with your practice now in segment two.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I grew up in Southwest Ohio. I reside in Cincinnati, but I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, about an hour north. And after high school, I attended Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And I originally thought I was going to be an architect. I always liked architecture. I still like architecture. And that was my, you know, when you apply to go to school, that was the major I selected. And so when my father and I went for orientation in the middle of the summer, I kind of saw the curriculum and I'm like, I don't know if I want to do this, because I wasn't really sold on the curriculum. And so I opted to, you know, undecided, the famous major of undecided, going into my freshman year. And I, you know, in Miami is a liberal arts school where, and I was in the arts and science where you had to take a foreign language and history and a variety of things. So I made sure I got those core courses out of the way. And then my sophomore year, I took principles of economics, microeconomics, and I had a fantastic professor, Dennis Sullivan, who was very good, but has also had a great sense of humor. And he made economics very interesting. And I was like, oh, this is kind of neat. And, you know, the genesis of me, you know, going down that path was, you know, my late father was a regular and avid viewer of Lewis Rukeyser's Wall Street Week. If you recall that on PBS, it was on Friday nights at 8:30. And in my home at growing up, we had one television, had cable, and that was my dad's television in the den. So if I wanted to watch a Reds game or something like that, I had to wait for him to watch, you know, get through his itinerary of Lewis Rukeyser. And sometimes I would sit in there and listen. And Rukeyser would have, you know, Milton Friedman and Peter Lynch and, you know, all these famous people on there. And I remember my father handed me a Friedman book. He goes, you might want to read this one summer. And I did. And I'm like, okay, this is kind of interesting. You know, interest rates and what it means and so forth. But, you know, economics can drive you in any direction. If you have a degree in there, you go to law school. A lot of people work for the federal government. But, you know, I was really drawn into financial services because in my family, I had two interesting experiences, one very bad and one very good. And it was really revolved around who got good advice. And I'll share with you that story. My grandparents, my grandfather worked for Frigidaire for 40 years. He ran the factory in Dayton, Ohio. And long, you know, great career. And, you know, when you retired in the 70s, you know, this was before 401ks, you know, you had a pension plan. And my grandfather was in very good health. Alternatively, my grandmother was not in good health. She was regularly sick. She'd smoked for years and years and years. And so when it came his selection of what kind of annuity payout do I get for my pension? Well, I'm going to outlive grandma. So he chose life only. And it seemed like a great idea. They lived really well. They had a little place in Anna Maria Island, Florida. They got new cars every couple of years. But guess what? My grandfather passed away before my grandma. I got sick out of the blue and it was over. And my grandma, the money dried up. Yep. And the last few years of her life, she had to get help from my mom and my aunt, and my uncle, and she was on Social Security. And it was really, really tough. And I thought to myself, geez, you know, they chose this on such a whim. It was such poor planning. And then on the flip side of that are my parents. My mother was a high school English teacher. My father was a mathematician for the Department of Defense. And so they weren't wealthy executives, but they did, you know, they did well by themselves. They saved a lot, and they both retired in their 50s. And I thought, you know, what did they do right? And, you know, I picked the brain of my father for a while, and he, you know, he did a lot of research on his own. He's a buy and hold investor, and he never bought stock. He bought mutual funds, and he relied on the Forbes honor roll, which used to come out. And it were really funds that did well in down markets. And my father always said, you know, I want to do well. I don't need to lead the pack, but I want to do well when the markets are dicey. And it worked. And, you know, like I said, he retired in his 50s. You know, he passed away in 2021 at the age of 90. He lived a great long life and he never had to worry about money in retirement. Not a worry. And so I saw that as well. You know, here's someone who figured it out. Here's someone who didn't, and they, you know, they're in my family. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of people probably like that. And I started to get interest in how that was done. I started reading Money Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, and it started to accumulate into a personal interest in the field. Upon graduation from Miami, I went into started at a bank. And I got myself into the trust employee benefits division, where they were specializing in this kind of radical new retirement plan called the 401k. And it was growth on steroids. I mean, it was going gangbusters. If you recall what was going on, And so we worked with, you know, we had investment division and employee benefits admin division, and I'd be there, and they'd build these plans for all these businesses, small manufacturers, real estate companies, 200 employees or fewer. And at the time in the late 80s, it was the same usual suspects. They want to make sure they added to every plan. Got to have Fidelity Magellan, got to have Fidelity Growth Company. And you thought about that for, okay, these are the hot funds. Yeah. But if you lift it under the hood and you look back now, you figured out that, wow, they're all kind of the same. You really weren't doing them any favors by adding these three funds that basically invested in all the same stocks. So it was a learning curve and a learning experience, but it was really good experience because you sat there from a corporate level at giving advice about, okay, these participants need some guidance. And that's where it sort of fostered itself to where I started to look at this from a perception of, do I want to be it from the high level of corporate point of view, or do I really want to be more individual? And after a couple of years in banking, I decided to go back and get my MBA. And I went to Xavier University in Cincinnati. And I started part-time while I was at the bank. And if you've ever been a student part-time, it makes for some very long days. And after a while, about a year and a half or 2 years of that, I got to where I was maybe 30 hours from getting my MBA. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to bite the bullet. I'm going to get a small student loan. I had two roommates at the time, really low rent, and I'm just going to get this done. And got it done. And, you know, I was a full-time student again for about a year. Problem with that was when I got all finished up, it was, middle of the late 1991 in the heart of recession. So I was like, okay, what am I going to do?
Now, can I pause you there just for a
absolutely.
Second? Absolutely. Now, was this back when a recession was actually two straight quarters of negative growth? Or is that
it was a real recession. Yes.
Okay. Cool.
And 91 was a little rough. It was rough on the labor market. And it was pretty hard to have somebody talk to you because everybody basically froze all their hiring plans the second half of the year. And that's when I was, started to look, but it was really around, I started investigating being a registered rep with an insurance company. Started looking into some of that thing. What were the pros and cons of that? I realized I wasn't going to be a great salesman. That was just not in my DNA. Consultative sales is one thing, but just, knock on the door, cold call, that I'm just not cut that way. I'm just not, that's not how I'm programmed. And so I figured that was probably going to be pretty tough. But I did come to a couple of conclusions, and in my investigations, it was, the first thing I figured out was, the golden rule is still very, very important. You want to treat those people you serve like you would want to be treated. And I always thought, if I wouldn't ask my parents to do this, I shouldn't ask somebody else to do this. And for me, that mattered. Being a fiduciary and to this day is still extremely important. Of put your client's interest first. And that was always very important to me. And I wanted to align myself with a firm that was like that. And so there were some who weren't, that wasn't part of, and I got that. I figured it out and I figured I'm not the right fit. And that was okay. But for a while it was tough. It was tough sledding, figuring out what I wanted to do, find the right place to go. I ended up landing at an insurance company that's headquartered here in Cincinnati, and and they liked the fact that I had an MBA and I had some retirement plan background, where I was started to consult with their agents and their registered reps, and primarily on retirement planning, IRAs, SEP IRAs, rollovers, and it was good. It was good because I got to work with those agents, with their clients. So I was sitting at the table. I wasn't the lead, but I was there as an expert. But the best thing that allowed me to do was they encouraged me to go get my CFP. And I did that. And it was a lot different than it is now, but you had your modules and you had to study and you could only take your exam at certain times. But after a few years of that, I got my CFP in 1997. And that, you know, and I was content. Okay, I'm doing all right. I like this. This is okay. I still wouldn't mind being in front of clients more. And then I got a unique opportunity, just out of whim. Deloitte & Touche was looking for a financial planner in their tax division. They were expanding their tax division to have private client advisors. It was called PCA, where they would do a full-fledged, not just the tax return work, but state and gift, and just some hard level planning. And I thought, you know, that I've got a newly minted CFP. This is client work with a good firm that is, going out of their comfort zone, doing something different. I think this might be a really interesting challenge. And in 1997, I joined Deloitte. And, it was probably the pinnacle event that happened for me, because I got myself around some really smart people. I got trained really, really well. And when you go to a big four accounting firm, I'm not an accountant. They didn't care. Like, you're going to learn tax code. And, I'm like, oh, geez, it was a great experience. You really learn the intricacies of the tax code, because it affects so many things, your retirement plan decisions, your estate planning decisions, cash flow, you name it. And it was a really great experience. And I got to work with some fabulous people, really well respected and very knowledgeable in their fields. And as that practice started to grow, I got a lot of responsibility. And I had a couple partners that, after a while, I started to see some opportunities, and I would go to them and say, what if we did this? And, one of the unique instances we had was we were, Deloitte audit Procter & Gamble, which is also headquartered here in Cincinnati. And there was a retirement program that Procter & Gamble did for its people who were contemplating retirement, where they would pay for a two-hour consultation with a Deloitte person to run the numbers and say, okay, what's your spending? Here's how much you have in your retirement plan. And based on inflation and so forth, you've got enough to retire, or maybe you need to wait a while. And I got fully embedded into that. And it was terrific, because I met a lot of people. I got to counsel a lot of people. And I started to see and learn really the fundamental planning parts of what makes people tick. And, and Procter had done, the stock had done very well in the 80s. And there was a lot of people, Procter & Gamble, executives who were very wealthy, had stock options, but there's also people who worked in the plants that were leaving with multiple millions of dollars because the stock had done so well, and they needed guidance. They weren't getting the kind of advice that they needed just because they weren't executives or they weren't in the C-suite. And that was the opportunity that kind of threw my way. And I said, I think we can do something here across the board. And a couple of the partners at Deloitte say, okay, I see what you're doing. Run with this, see what happens. Don't surprise us. What's your business plan? And I kind of rolled out the idea of, when these people retire, if they don't have an advisor, then maybe we could be the place for them. We're non-discretionary. We didn't sell any investments. We didn't take custody of assets, but we were the consultants to them. And the analogy I used to use is, I tell the client, you are the CEOs of your portfolio and of your plan. We're kind of like the CFOs. We crunch numbers. We tell you, okay, here's the issue. Here are the avenues you can take, the pros and cons of each. What do you want to do? And that really worked. And, when I started at Deloitte in this fledgling practice in Cincinnati, just Cincinnati, we had two clients. I think we had $40,000 of annual revenue. And I think 10 years later, we had north of 35 clients and $1.2 million of revenue. And I'm not responsible for all of that, but I was involved in a growth engine that was really spectacular. And I learned a ton. And what's great are a number of these clients I started working with back then I still serve today at Esperient. I'll get into how that played out here in a little bit. But that's kind of my journey. In 2010, being an auditor of SEC clients, which all the big four firms are, having an RIA under your umbrella is a little, let's say, can be troubling when they're dealing with the SEC.
Yeah.
And in 2010, this is after, what happened in 08 and Sarbanes-Oxley was rolling out. And there was a lot of that. And a number of the big four firms decided to get out of the RIA business. First, there was Ernst & Young. And then Deloitte was worried, okay, what's going to happen? Do all these people leave? And or can we find a good landing zone for these clients? And I'll give Deloitte a ton of credit. They didn't go with the highest bidder. They found a right home. And it wasn't just Cincinnati practice. We have a practice in Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Detroit, Cincinnati, New York, and Boston. And this was all part of the transaction with Esperient in 2010, where basically the investment arm within Deloitte was sold to Esperient. Now, Esperient CEO Rob Francis happens to be a former Deloitte tax partner. And, and it was real important for Deloitte to find a right home for us and these clients. And, and Rob being a former tax partner and a number of the other people at Esperient having big four experience, we use the term cut from the same cloth. And both entities were, and it was the right avenue. And during the course of 2010, that little section in those offices at Deloitte became members of Esperient in October 1st of 2010. And that's how I ended up at Esperient, and being part of the Cincinnati practice. And so a number of those offices are still part of Esperient today. A number of those clients are still with Esperient today. It's just been an interesting journey, to say the least.
Wow. Wow. Tim, I don't know if we've ever had anybody give a better, timeline and everything from beginning, because a lot of times I'll have to throw in a few extra questions or whatever, but that was fantastic. That was awesome. And thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Is there anything you want to interject on anything? Because I know that was the time.
Well, no, it was really good. I just, I think it's really important for the listeners to understand, like when somebody goes through, being in the financial services industry is one thing and selling products, but there's a lot more to it. And the tax side of it is so important, because it's really not what you make, it's what you get to keep. And the taxes are planning and everything. So I really like Paul's background. Working with one of the major CPA firms and accounting firms in the world, gave him a lot of insight. And then he took something, ran with it. True entrepreneurial spirit. So that's cool. So what we'll do is we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll get into more about what Paul's doing today to take care of his clients and their assets. We'll be right back.
Estate planning. What does that even mean? When the inevitable happens for everyone on this planet, your estate plan kicks into action. But first, let's start with what an estate is. An estate is simply everything you own. Now, here's the issue and what needs to be understood when this event occurs. You only have two choices on this plan. Number one, either you plan how your estate gets handed out and distributed to those you leave behind. Or number two, your state decides who gets everything you own. For the first time ever, you can now take complete and total control of this plan that you've been deprived of for most of your life and generations before you. You can get personalized assistance along the way with a team of specialists whose job it is to make sure you have true peace of mind. It's important to understand that estate planning is a journey, and rest assured that our team will be available to you all along the way and at every step. Welcome to Estate Plan, home of the last estate plan you'll ever need. To learn more, make sure to reach out to your local advisor licensed with us or go to our website for more information.
What's up, Enrichers? Tim James here with my co-host Carter Wilcoxon. Today in the house, we've got Paul Nicolai. And Paul, you've had a really good background story. Appreciate that. Now, I kind of want to, why don't you just pick up where we just left off? Let's talk about like what you're doing today and your practice and how you're helping clients.
Yeah, this is a great industry because, you know, I work with a lot of different people, as I'm sure you do and you have. And I would say I've never done the same thing twice. Even if I've got people who retire from the same company, and then so they have the same generator of wealth, but everybody thinks a little differently. And that's why it's a great industry. I think what we're seeing today is a function of several things. Obviously the elephant in the room is, we're 2 years after a lockdown that completely changed how people think and how people work. It's changed how people view even their own mortality. I think that, I'm sure from the estate planning side of things, that's a topic that people like to put off. It's macabre. I don't want to deal with my pending, death. I'll get to that one day. But I think a lot of people sort of sat up and say, who's the beneficiaries of our life insurance and who's, how are we going to settle our estate? And I think people, if there's any silver lining out of that, maybe it woke people up to the point where it's time to think about some things you don't necessarily want to think about, just so your family isn't left out in the cold. And I think that's some of it. And a lot of it is really around uncertainty. The market was great last year. And I think, what happened in March of 2020, when the markets went down, it was a self-inflicted recession. We just basically flipped a switch. Let's turn off the economy. And then we flipped it back on and whoom, the markets just steamrolled. Nobody really saw that coming the way it did. And it caught so many people off guard. And I think people got complacent too, where, all I got to do is buy an index and I'm good. Or I buy a few of the big tech behemoths, the FANG stocks, or I'll be good. And it worked up through the end of last year. I mean, the S&P was up 28%, and growth was everywhere, and the U.S. was leading out of the gate. And as a firm, we've been very cautious probably 18 to 24 months ago. Just these valuations can't keep up. We're getting way ahead of ourselves. And so we started to plant those seeds with clients that, listen, if you've got cash needs coming up, maybe we'll start thinking about that. It's kind of counterintuitive. Why would I want to do that? Look what the markets are doing. And cash is paying nothing. And bonds are paying nothing. Those are sometimes difficult conversations. And some people, they had to go kicking and screaming to understand that, listen, you need to pull out $200,000 next year for required minimum distributions, for instance. Let's raise that cash while the markets are good and we don't have to worry about that. And we did a lot of that in December. In hindsight, it worked out brilliantly because we knew people had to take out money. And we said, listen, the markets are ending on a high note in December. Let's raise the cash. If we're wrong, you still got money invested. If we're right, you don't have to sell anything to raise the cash that you have to pull out because the government's telling you to pull out. And so those conversations worked out really well. But I think there's a lot of uncertainty with people. Obviously, we haven't had inflation for decades. And, what you see, inflation is a tax on everyone. And, you talk to anybody who has to fill up their gas tank or vendors, we had an appliance repairman come last week because our ice maker died on our refrigerator. And, he's like, all this is added cost because we have to fill up our delivery trucks at $4.75 a gallon versus $2.75 a gallon. And that affects everybody. And I think that worries a lot of people and it affects everybody. Regardless of income, you're feeling that. So I think there's a lot of angst about just how things are going to settle. I think the pandemic, changed some perception about how people view, obviously their own livelihoods, but, how they see things, but also, what's in store for their family, for their kids, their grandkids. And they start thinking about a little more holistically, you know, of what matters. And sometimes, you know, when you can't go to a ball game and you can't go to a movie and you can't go to a concert, like we are locked up, you know, and you take a lot of walks and you start thinking about stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I think some people came away with that saying, okay, we have some things we want to address. Some people are still contemplating what they want to do. And that's natural. But some people, you know, took away from this. This was, you know, something that I can't ignore any longer. And just from a high level of planning, you know, what I want my families to have, how much we're spending, you know, are we doing the right things? Have we been neglecting anything? So a lot of people have, you know, if we're running financial plans for them, they've asked, so let's rerun this. We know we've got a higher inflation rate. The markets have corrected the first, you know, six months of this year. So my AUM is a little different and maybe I've got different goals. And so a lot of people are going down that path to reevaluate their situations.
Well, let's, Paul, let me jump in and ask you, let's talk a little bit about your clientele. Obviously, you know, you had the whole, the sale that took place in 2010, Experient comes in, they're the, right. The ideal suitor. You've been with them obviously during that whole transition. What do your clients that you're working with day in and day out, what do they look like? You know, like what's their, you know, their persona, so to speak.
Sure.
And then what is it that, you know, some of the key things that you're doing now to help with that angst that they're, you know, dealing with of the unknown and what the future looks like?
Yeah. You know, the client makeup is I've got a lot of retirees. You know, we have a lot of Fortune 500 companies here in Cincinnati, Procter & Gamble, Kroger, to name a few. And so I've got a fair amount of retirees, a lot of small or privately held business owners or in the C-suite of a private business. You know, they worked several years at a private business, maybe got distributions, maybe had some share value, either still working there or maybe they've retired. So some people who, you know, spent their lives, extra capital was plowed back into their business. And then all of a sudden, you know, retirement comes, or if they have a liquidity event, they sell. It's like, okay, I've got, you know, liquid cash. What do I do? You know, I've been plowing money back into my business, my widget company or whatever it is, for years and years and years. Now I've got, I don't have to do that anymore. And I've got this liquidity. Well, how do I handle this? You know, and sometimes it's almost, you treat it like a lottery winner. Let's take a step back. And sometimes that counseling starts with, okay, we're not going to do anything for the first 3 months. We're going to talk, it's going to sit in cash. And we're just going to talk through, all right, what do you need this money for? Is there any more money? What's the tax? You know, obviously there's going to be a tax implication. Sometimes people forget that. You got to set aside six digits of cash because Uncle Sam's going to become calling come tax time. And you go through these expectations. So business owners, some execs, you know, most of the clientele we serve, a lot of it comes from referral. Existing clients, some other referral from other professionals, CPAs, attorneys. Some of the clients that I still serve still use Deloitte for their tax preparation. So even though we've left Deloitte, you know, some of those colleagues of my former colleagues of mine, I'm still, you know, we still sit at the same table once a year with a client, which is great. It, you know, so you keep those relationships. But it's also good that the client sees this integration of service, is that even though my business card looks a little different, it changed, they're still getting good service and they're still getting good advice from the tax side and from the investment and wealth planning side, even though my business card's different. So that's a little bit of background of the clients that I tend to serve. I think my colleagues would be probably in the same boat, executives, business owners, for the most part.
Are you doing anything? Cause obviously your background originally, you know, you're talking about how you were, you know, registered rep and, you know, like more in the 401k, you know, retirement plan advisory space or whatever. And obviously you, you know, you, you've adapted a little bit more and now you retirees, right? So you got a lot of people that are in their beginning stages. And I'm going back to the, in the first segment, when you're talking about, you know, here were your grandparents, Frigidaire, 40 years, died broke because you didn't know all these different things, right? And then you got, you know, your dad, who sounds like he was a Milton Friedman fan, and, you know, inflation was probably a commonplace conversation, I'm sure, for many years, even after that, between the two of you. And then, so then you have like the people who have gone through their accumulation phase. Now it's more about the decumulation and the tax mitigation and risk mitigation, things of that nature. It sounds like all of that experience really has served you well to serve your clients very well. I'm just wondering, do you do much in that, you know, getting started, maybe Henry's, as they call them, right? High earners, not rich yet, I think is what that stands
great,
for.
Great question. And we, you know, our firm has actually realized that that was something we needed to address. And, you know, because we had a lot of G2, you know, second generation folks, adult children, who all of a sudden, you know, if we had a wealthy client who started to make trust distributions, these are kids in their adult, maybe in their 30s, and all of a sudden they're becoming wealthy. And so that generational wealth, we call it, you know, the Gen Now wealth, but we've actually got a group within the firm who specializes in that area, both in the deliverable side. So they'll have, you know, webinar presentations, they'll do some newsletter work specific to people like that who are just like, okay, I'm working, I'm getting into my, you know, I'm really hitting all cylinders of my salary, my life. But now, you know, by the grace of God, my parents or my family, I'm starting to get even more wealth and I'm starting to get real world problems. You know, I'm getting big tax bills, or now I've got kids, I got to start thinking about, you know, 529 plans and things like that. So we, as a firm, have done a very nice job at setting up a whole separate entity group within the firm who specializes. They meet regularly, and they stay on top of it from the standpoint of what are these people, you know, they interview a lot of these folks. What's most important to them? What problems do they have that we need to solve? And that's all we, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah,
we're problem solvers.
Yep,
we solve problems, and you know, and it's just a different way of doing it. And so I think that, you know, that's something that, especially in this young age, you know, today everything's been, you know, you even have, you know, I have a daughter who's just graduated from college and starting her first job at Oracle, and you know, and she's excited about it, and so much digital information now, so much is done remotely and digitally. That you got to think about, you know, how you deliver things. Yep. You know, I still have clients who want paper reports. You know, you got to print them off and get them. And now today they don't want paper. They want it all digital. They want to go to a portal, see it all there. They want to pop it up on an app on their phone or on their iPad. And what can we deliver that meets their expectations, but it still does what they want to do? And that's one of the challenges, you know, so that you take our business and then you incorporate all the other things like IT and compliance, and what can we do that's going to keep it in tone that these people want and desire, as far as giving them a solution set to the things that are important to them.
Well, I remember whenever I spoke with you originally, and I think it might've been like 6 weeks ago or whatever, but you know, you were telling me a lot of this stuff, and I'm like, man, there are so many like philosophical alignments, and the way that, you know, you guys work together, sort of like the, you know, one-stop shop type of a mentality. And I've said this for, you know, for 6 or 7 years now that we have our foundational approach, which really is like estate planning and legacy planning and all that stuff, and how we help advisors in that arena, especially like in the independent space, for sure, they don't have the type of resources that you've got that connected team internally there and everything. The thing that that really impressed me was how, you know, you pride yourself on understanding, I don't know everything, but if I surround myself with the right, you know, cast of characters, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. Then my clients can win from all those things. And as they get older, they're not looking to be spread out all over the place. They're looking to consolidate, right? And I would venture a guess that you guys have seen that type of clientele, that they're like, hey, Paul's my guy. He knows all the things I need. I don't know all the things he does, but he's got all the people that know all the things that need to be done.
Yeah. And I can't overemphasize the bench strength that we have at Asperian. And we had that at Deloitte. We really did. But Deloitte, you know, the RIA was just a small component to Deloitte's, you know, Deloitte next to McKinsey is the largest professional services firm in the world, audit, tax, consulting, but the RIA was just, you know, just small. And then going to Asperian, that's all we do is wealth and investments and so forth. But it's funny, you can find somebody who has experience in every topic imaginable at our firm, and it is a blessing. It can be something, you know, from the tax side, wealth planning side, estate side, whether it's qualified plan, inherited IRA, ESG investing, you name it.
Right.
I've got somebody who's got a very good dossier. And if the client says, I got a specific question or need, I've probably got the resource. And it really is beneficial. It's a blessing to have that. And it makes our firm unique. And, one thing that's interesting about our business is that there's so many varieties of firms who do what we do. You've got, you know, small, you know, RIA space or registered rep space. You've got huge conglomerates owned by banks and private equity, insurance companies. You know, we're employee owned and we pride ourselves on that. It's a little different. We think it's the right way to go, where I have 74 partners. I'm a partner. I have 74 other partners, and we have a stake in what goes on with our firm. And we're not tied to an insurance company or private equity or a bank or a sovereign fund or anything like that. So we make decisions on the behalf of the business, which is also, you know, the clients have a stake that we're making good decisions. So they've got a place to call home for generation after generation. But it's unique. Our industry is really changing. I don't know if you follow it, but the amount of, you know, acquisition and mergers and transactions that occurred in the last 5 to 10 years is just stunning.
It's crazy. It seems like another day where I'm hearing, Hightower's buying this or Cap Trust buying that, or, I mean, it is, I mean, it's been a congregation of conglomerations, I guess.
Oh yeah. And the thing is that, you know, that's really tough on clients.
Yeah.
Is my person still going to be there? Yes, no, maybe. Are the service line going to be the same? Yes, no, maybe.
Yeah.
Am I going to matter? You know, a client might say, I matter at this smaller firm, but the patriarch of the firm wants to retire and his succession plan is to sell to a bank, and the bank's got other, you know, you're just a small fish. And this client all of a sudden says, yeah, I'm not getting any attention. I can't get my phone calls returned. You know, that's a real issue. But it's, you know, the amount of money chasing firms, and a lot of it is succession. I don't blame a lot of these firms.
Sure.
You know, that's their plan. And maybe they haven't thought through it. The patriarch 65, and like, I don't want to keep doing this. And maybe, you know, maybe I have a son or daughter who's in the business with me, but maybe I don't. But maybe I have someone I can sell this to who works for me. Can we make the finances work? You know, all those things are up in the air. And sometimes they say, well, I'm just going to do this way, and away we go. And hopefully it works out. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
And you hear stories like that.
And you know what you said right there is something that I've been saying for a long time. And I know we're coming up on the most important part of the health and wealth, which is the health side. I get it.
Yeah.
Tim James smiling there. But the thing that is, And I lost my train of thought thinking about the health section.
Well, it's time to go to commercial break.
I love it. I'll think about what it is, but you know, I know what I was gonna say. I say this all the time, right? We are in the relationship business, and your clients, right? They don't call you their trusted advisor for no reason, mm-hmm. right? They trust you for things other than just, I mean, I'm sure you become friends these people, right? I mean, because, so your point is, yeah, it's a great succession plan. And I've got this, you know, this EBITDA, and I got this AUM, and I got this recurring revenue and all that stuff that, you know, someone's going to come in and buy. But it's the relationship that really, really matters to the people who entrusted you to help them along the way. So that is an interesting dichotomy in that transitional period mm-hmm. of what's going to happen, especially when it becomes intergenerational wealth.
Oh, right? Yeah. No question. And you hit the nail on the head. You know, it's funny. You know, I tell clients, you know, yeah, my oldest is now working. She's like, I remember when she was born. And that you remember, you know, they know these little things, and they'll call you and ask you, you know, non-financial questions because you are that trusted advisor. You know, should I lease a car or buy a car? Should I do this? I'm like, I don't know. You know, I'm like, I can look into it. They ask those kind of questions, and that's great. You know, that's the relationship you really, really want. Those are great relationships. They trust you on virtually anything. You know, I want your opinion on something.
Well, when clients start asking you what type of toothbrush to buy, you know, you've got a good relationship.
Sure.
Well, good segment, guys. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to get into everything about health. We'll be right back.
Great.
Want the absolute best for yourself, and you want it to be easy. That's why we created Green 85. It helps with detoxifying the body gently. We're proud it's chemical-free, unlike almost all other supplements you'll find. Bottom line, Green 85 will get you healthier. We look forward to hearing what Green 85 did for you.
To get this product and our other amazing products, go to chemicalfreebody.com. That's chemicalfreebody.com.
What's up, Enrichers? Tim James here. I'm back with my co-host, Carter Wilcox. And again, today in the house, we've got Paul and Nikolai. And today, or tonight, right now, we're going to switch gears. We're going to be talking about health. So, Paul, this is the segment where you get to ask me any question on health for yourself, family members, friends, public health, whatever. What you got, buddy?
You know, this is good stuff. I told Carter when we first had our first conversation, I'm a soccer player. I started playing soccer when I was 5 years old. I'll be 57 in November. I still play. I play on a travel team of over 50-year-olds here in Cincinnati. And we go around and play various tournaments around the country over the course of the year. And it's a blast. It's a lot of fun. And I remember when I was in high school and played, I would experiment with pregame meals. I would, you know, I read a book called Nutrition for Athletes, you know, years and years ago. And I would start thinking about, okay, how far in advance of my game do I eat? 3 hours, 4 hours, you know? And then I'd think about, okay, is it the traditional pasta, or is it pancakes, or is it something else? And I would experiment and try to figure out what was best. And so, you know, I'm in all the science now. I'd be very interested in, you know, what do you think is the best pregame meal for? And this is something like, you know, soccer or a 5K or 10K or something that's going to demand a lot of cardio, but also a lot of energy. What would you say is probably, you know, in your opinion is some of the things to think through.
Sure, man. First, I'm kind of curious, what did you come up with your experiments? What worked best for you?
I found that I play best when my stomach's almost empty.
Yeah.
And so if I eat 4 hours before a game, if I was a night game, I would eat 4 hours in advance. I found that I had a really good wheat bread, and I'd melt Swiss cheese and make a cheese sandwich with wheat bread and a banana. That was pretty good. Pancakes were always good because I'm a sucker for pancakes. I found that, you know, the old adage way back when was, you know, steak and potato. And that never worked for me. It was too much protein. But I always found that the pancake or the wheat sandwich seemed to be the best four hours plus before a game.
Okay, cool. That's good stuff. So, well, I'll just, you know, and when I share this with you, usually it's hard for people to grasp what I'm about to share, especially because of our programming and the way we eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I remember being an athlete. It was like, we were told you guys need to eat a lot of pasta because you need the carbs for energy. And so we were eating a lot of food, and sometimes we'd have big meals before the game. So here's what I've discovered is that, like, at the Hippocrates Health Institute, where I kind of started my journey, they've actually worked with Olympic level athletes, and they've helped quite a few of them win gold medals. They've never gotten credit for it. A lot of these people are not talking about it. Venus Williams is one of them. You know, I don't remember when she was diagnosed with lupus, and mm-hmm. she was kind of on the outs in her career, and she, you know, was probably worth at the time estimated $60 million. So she had enough money to get the best doctors in the world, literally. And they were all telling her the same thing. There was not much that they could do for her. It's an autoimmune disorder. And then she went to Hippocrates, and after a couple of weeks was at Dr. Clement's desk saying, "Why do I feel so good? Everything you're telling me to do here is the exact opposite of everything I've been told." He said, "That's why it works." Right. So it's like, so she ended up coming, you know, basically healing herself with the lifestyle, and went on to win a gold medal and then won Wimbledon. Right. And then her sister, Serena, started adopting a lot of these practices. So with that said, you were asking a question about, like, what to eat, when's the best time to eat. So those Olympic level athletes, depending on the person, the type of event they were doing, they would sometimes have them not eat one day, sometimes 2 days before an event, no heavy food. But what they did do was they filled them full of nutrient rich juices is what they did. So let me explain this. So the bottom line is like, why do we eat? What's the purpose of food? Well, it's to get nutrients into our cells. So to do that, that food has to be converted into liquid, right? It's going to have to go through your digestive tract, go through the process, liver and the gallbladder, and bile is going to hit the fat and all this stuff, goes through the duodenum, then goes into the small intestine. There are these little hair-like structures, these villi. They're going to pull the nutrients into the bloodstream and then hopefully get into the cell. That's the whole point. Then the cell can use that. So it has to be in liquid form. So what a lot of people don't understand is literally 60 to 80% of our energy on a daily basis is used to process these heavy foods just to get them to the point where they can be in the blood so they can hopefully be absorbed. So when you think about that, this is where there's fasting comes in, and fasting is very powerful for mental clarity. Because what happens is, if you think about it, if you have all this energy that's being used in digestion, it's not going to be used in your brain or your arms or extremities for sports or activities of daily living. And I'm not saying everybody's going to fast and not eat. What I'm saying is, what they would do is they would take literally juices that were made of vegetables like cucumber and celery, but also sprouts, like living foods. So this is like a whole nother level. I'm just going to tell you the top of the food chain here. So when these biophotons come from our sun and they land on the leaf of a plant, they're captured via photosynthesis, turned into electrons. So when you're consuming, like every creature on the planet, I mean, look at wild creatures. They got a lot of jazz in them, right? They're like a chipmunk, you know, and a deer, they just run. They have all this energy and they're very fit. It's because they're consuming 24/7 living foods. They're eating foods right on the spot that are chock full of electrons via the biophotons of the sun. So this is like a battery pack. When you're consuming those foods, your teeth are like conductors, and that you're literally charging yourself, and then the food goes in you and it charges as well. Now, this isn't woo-woo. I've seen it with something called Kirlian photography, where they actually do a video and you can actually see kind of like a night scope, you know, like when you're seeing, it's like people running through the forest, the jungle, you see the red and yellow outline, you can see the heat map. So it's kind of like that, but it's really measuring your biophoton energy, your energetics. So it's like a light coming off of you. Right, through this Kirlian photography. And it's really interesting. So they took an athlete, this person, and they actually gave them, I think we talked about this maybe last time too, but it was a hamburger, French fries, and a milkshake. And every single time that person took a bite of these cooked processed foods and his Adam's apple went up and down, the biofrequency on Curly and Photography, you can see it go down. Took her to buy a french fries, down. Buy a drink of the milkshake, down, down, down. Then they let him drink some water, waited half an hour to an hour. And then they went and literally took sprouts, harvested them, juiced them, and then handed him the glass. And every time he took a drink and his Adam's apple went down, his biophoton energy on Curly and Photography, and it got expanded and it went up. So the ultimate, depending on the event that you're doing, it would be to be replacing heavy meals with juices the day of, or even sometimes the day before the event. Now, I know some people that are out there that are maybe like ultra marathoners, triathletes, it's hot stuff. You're going to be burning an excessive amount of calories. And this is where we would actually add in like beets, right? Mm-hmm. We might have them maybe take spoonfuls of raw coconut oil, right, to get some high quality fat in there. And we would do stuff like this. So those people have the ability to burn through more of these sugars and stuff like that, and they're going to need that. But the average person, you know, I would, especially in juice format, I would try to stay away from, you know, sugary stuff like most of the apples, except for maybe green apples, but most apples, carrots, and beets and stuff like that, especially if you're going to be doing a lot of it and doing it every day, and go more towards green stuff. So for you, you said you're 57?
57 in November. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're 57. And, if I was in your shoes and I wanted to optimize myself, then I wouldn't eat that day, but I would have a lot of really good concentrated juices. Like we have a green powder called Green A5. I'd put a scoop of that in there. And I'd probably even mix that in with like a sprouted nut milk. That way you're getting those high quality fats in there, and shake that up together and drink it. And, you know, maybe add some type of a high quality beet powder that doesn't have a bunch of crap in it, which is hard to find. There's a lot of good stuff in beets that increase nitric oxide production, which is increasing blood flow and stuff like that. Yeah. And then at your age, I'd be really become very astute at what I can do to reduce inflammation and recover faster. And that's something I excel at and I've been able to do for my own personal health, and then shared with like tons of guys and gals that, you know, are 40 and beyond that are still in the game. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? They still enjoy sure. to participate. They enjoy to compete. They enjoy to do that kind of stuff. And we give them huge advantages so that they can do like my friend John, like years and years ago, he got into cyclocross. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I am.
You ever done that?
I have not. I've seen it. I used to cycle criteriums when I was in college. I did some of that, but I've never done cyclocross.
Okay. Well, John's about your age. It's about your age. I think he might even be 60 now, but he, very, very fit guy. He used to like do wakeboarding in Mount Hood okay. in the summertime in the Hood River in the Columbia, and then in Maui in the winter, back and forth. Very athletic. And then he got into cyclocross racing. And there was this young guy who was in his late 20s, and they had a little rivalry going all the time, and they're always challenging each other, right? So John would always try to go down into younger age groups because he was kind of smoking everybody in his class. So and he was challenging this kid, but the kid always beat him. Well, we kind of helped him with some detoxes, gut, nutrition, all this stuff. And I said, well, John, how did the meat go? And he's like, dude, he's like, I blew him away. I beat him by a minute or something like that, or 30 seconds, whatever it was. It was, and I said, well, that's really good. He goes, no, you don't understand. He goes, in cyclocross, that's a freaking eternity. He goes, I said, well, let's get everybody. I want to help everybody out there in your age group and all this. He's like, nah, I ain't telling nobody about this. I was like, what? Come on, dude, help me out. I got this great client over here. We can help more people. He's like, yeah, they'll figure it out themselves. He goes, this is my little secret. So I'm like, okay, whatever. So you can't blame the guy.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter what age you are. You are a being, and you have hundreds of trillions of cells, and those cells need nutrients. So if we're looking at it, and we need things that are going to go in there and reduce inflammation, right? So in saunas, I don't know if you told about the sauna, Carter, but I would be on that sauna every day. It'll cut your inflammation in half, your recovery time in half. It'll make you feel good. It reduces stress. It'll help with your blood flow tremendously. And it'll help move those nutrients that you're putting into your body and getting the waste matter out. Because it's all about getting the bad stuff out and the good stuff in.
Yeah, saunas. Yeah, so. I did some reading about that, and I have access to one at our health club, and it does work. It does its job. I tried it and I'm like, wow, this does really work. You know, and it's hard this time of year when it's, you know, 95 outside and, you know, 80% humidity here in Southwest Ohio. We go and sit into a sauna, but all you have to do is
do it really early in the morning or late at night, and then finish it off with, you know, cold showers, you know, rinse off in a cold shower and then make it colder. Cause some people are like, I'm not going to get into a cold shower cause I think it's icicles. I'm like, look, just start out lukewarm, take your shower and then just kind of pare it down. And then that's an easier way. You can slowly acclimate to it and it's not a big deal. And then finish off with a 30 seconds or a minute of pretty darn cold. Yeah. And then after a while you'll work more into it. But then also, you know, when you're doing that, really focus on your breath. Because if you really focus on your breath going in and out as you're making the water colder, that makes it easier, way more tolerable. You'll get through it. It helps a bunch. And then it's also going to help you center yourself for your day. And there's just nothing wrong with breath work and meditation and being present.
So that's good advice. Didn't think about that.
And it's also good for inflammation too. Good for your nervous system. Get that contrast, hot, cold. In fact, hot, cold plunges, boy. If you can get that going on, where you can get a little cold plunge at your place and you can get like a hot tub and you can go back and forth 7 times, you come out of that deal like a spring chicken. You're ready to rock and roll. It's awesome. When I build this place and I get it done, I will have a hot cold contrast thing so I can do that 7 times.
I did an ice plunge once it'll wake you up. I did it after 2 soccer games one day after a tournament. And I came out feeling like the Tin Man. But the next day I felt great. It does work.
The first few times, I don't know what the magic number is, but it's 7. But if you do it the first 2 or 3 times you get in there, it's like 54 degrees water, you know, and then you go into the hot tub and you warm up, you go back and forth. But after about 3 or 4 times, it's not that bad. Your body kind of gets used to it. And if you do it every day after a while, you know, there's people from Iceland, they're pretty used to it. They've been doing it since they're babies. Look what Eskimos do, the way they live, for God's sake.
That's right. That's right.
We got to get some saunas up there too. They won't even know what to do with it.
that's for sure. Yeah. And that sauna, by the way, I don't know if I did talk to you about that or not, Paul, but that, you know, Tim, who's basically not only is he my co-host, but basically he's my, you know, health coach as well. And I get to learn all these
built things. In.
Yeah. but you know, he was saying to me for 6 months about this sauna, and we did a little promo on that. And then I'm like, dude, we got to tell everybody about these saunas, you know, because they're a one person sauna. It's in at my house. It's in our home gym that we have and everything. And I go in there every single day, typically in the morning. I need to start doing it at night too, because I've noticed I did it like twice at nighttime and then got in the shower, like you said, and just kind of like rinsed off. And I slept like a champ.
Yeah. Yeah. It's better for sleep. It's a sleep tool as well.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about here is the technology. I've sold saunas, Paul, for 9 years, and the big box wooden saunas, there's a lot of them out there, probably 90%+ of them that I wouldn't get in for many reasons. EMFs, ELFs, glues off gassing, panels are not in the proper position for maximum detoxification. Types of warranty they have are crappy. There are some good ones out there and they're great. They are infrared. They will work. It's just this little sauna actually broke a natural law. So it's different technology. They're actually computer processors. So you're getting 6 to 9 times the benefit. If you look at it from just a simple, like a biomechanics situation, it's like regular good saunas are going to raise your core temperature a degree to a degree and a half. That's excellent. This little sauna in 25 minutes can raise your core temperature 3.2 degrees. Mm-hmm. That means that we're getting massive amounts of blood flow increased. It's going to shrink your blood and your water molecules even more so that the blood can get smaller and get into dormant capillaries and start rejuvenating your body, your organs, and bringing nutrients to places it hasn't been in a while. And then also clearing out waste matter that's accumulated in those dormant areas. So it's quite profound. Pretty much everybody, in fact, I don't know if I've asked you, Carter, have you seen stuff coming out of you yet into the towel?
I haven't. I know you were talking about you. Obviously your journey and that you started like a little gray matter coming out of you.
I had gray stuff for 5 months pouring out. Now I grew up on a farm, you know, lead paint in the 70s, loading lead shotgun shells, lead fishing weights, making lead crappie jigs and all that kind of stuff. I work construction. I've been around a lot of, you know, my dad, I sat there spraying Roundup. I was around a lot of garbage, a lot of pollution. So all that stuff started really pouring out. This is a guy that had been taking a 30-minute sauna every day for 9 years. When I switched over a couple months later, all this stuff started pouring out of me. So that's pretty cool. So anyway, any other questions, my friend?
No, that was good. I thought that was good. I would say one more that one thing that I found during the lockdown of a couple of years ago, a lot of people gained weight. I actually lost weight. I lost 5 pounds because I had to get myself outside and do, I had to basically do it for mental health reasons. I ran, our trainer got us, a little HIIT workout we could do in the backyard or on the deck when the gym was closed for like 2 weeks. Also we have woods, where I live. And, George W. Bush, when he clears his head, he goes and clears brush down in his ranch in Texas. And I did the same thing. I started clearing out honeysuckle. And, I'd be down there for 3 hours and just, I'd come up dripping wet. And, at the end of the day, after the lockdown, I was like, God, I'm 5 pounds lighter. My clothes are loose and everything like that. And I don't know if you saw other things from other people. I know people gained weight, some people lost weight, but for me, it was more medicinal. And I sort of, now that, I've got this hybrid work now, some days at home, some days in the office, but that workout is all incorporated into my day. I did that before, but now it really is. I would look and plan accordingly. And I found that I sleep better, feel better, and I've cut out all kinds of little habits you had when you were at the office every day, 5 days a week. Yeah. And if you look for any kind of silver lining in that, awful time of year 2020, I think that might have been, at least from my point of view, that might have been something.
Well, it looks like you actually made your health a priority, which is what we always talk about. A lot of people did get all bummed out, and a lot of people, bought into all the fear porn on the news where they just fear you to death 24/7. And that's not good for your health. I mean, you're really, biochemically, fear creates, certain types of chemistry in the body that's not good. It can be used, like, it's great if, a lion's going to get you and you want to run away, but 24/7 living in a state of fear, it's, you really need to get out and move that out. Yeah. Like, but you need to work the body, move more movement to get that stuff out of there. That's why sports bars are really dumb, because these people get all excited, and then they don't move. Right? So they get all this, all this chemistry going in their body, and it's designed to be burned off and turns into a toxic poison. Yeah. And they're probably drinking beer.
Something really hard for my son. He's 20 now, but in 2020, he was, due to graduate from high school. And of course they didn't have graduation, no graduation parties, no senior week. And then going into his freshman year of college where, it was remote, or if you were on campus, you were masked up. And that really, and I think not just him, but a lot of kids like him, that took a lot out of those kids. And we struggle trying to get him to eat healthy and be healthy. And he's a 20-year-old, 20-year-olds will be rebellious and do what they want to do. And but that added layer of disappointment, uncertainty, combined was really tough, both mentally and physically. And it's something that my wife and I, we're both pretty healthy, and we're trying to coach our kids to be healthy, find the right thing that works for you, because it does mean a lot. And, a lot of the bad habits are reversible, but boy, if you do it when you're young, it's a hell of a lot easier than waiting till you get my age and then try to change habits, because that's what we're trying to coach our kids.
Yeah, there's a lot of emotional stuff. I couldn't even imagine being like my senior year in high school sports being derailed. My heart, it just goes out to those kids that had to deal with that, because they prep up for that whole, that's their senior year, and even in college or whatever, and then they can't even play. I just, it's just it's really unfortunate. So, but anyway, and I will say this too, for those of you out there, because I know there's probably a lot of sports fans listening as well, because I kind of hammered on you earlier about drinking beer and yelling and screaming. Maybe if your team scores a touchdown or your guy hits a hole in one, just jump down there and do push-ups until you can't do them anymore. Then hop back up and get back into the game. And maybe you're doing, do some sit-ups the next time they score or whatever. Do something, run in place, run around the house like you did when you were a kid, woo, and then make it a fun thing. Let's go. And we run around the house, come back in, get some of those endorphins out of you. All right. So we appreciate you coming on today, Paul. Great questions. I hope that you got it. Something from me today that you can actually take home and you can put into practice. So
yeah, well, I did. I appreciate it.
Making some change for you, brother.
No, it's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. And I thank you both for having me. It's been a good session.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Hey, and Richards, we want to thank you for joining us for another episode of the Health and Wealth Podcast. And to be able to see all of our previous fantastic guests, like Paul Nicolai of Asperient, you can go to our website at www.thehealthandwealthpodcastshow.com and make sure to like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, or Google. So for my fantastic co-host, Mr. Chemical Free Body himself, Tim James, I am Carter Wilcoxon, CEO and founder of CSI Financial Group and co-founder of Epic Services Company. Thank you for joining us today. Paul, seriously, so enjoyable having you on the show today. Your background, your experience, I mean, it was really, for me, inspiring, and a lot of great information that you shared today. And we really do thank you for taking, I know it's East Coast, your time, right? So it's later in the day than it is for me and Tim out here on the West Coast and everything. So it was very enjoyable. And thank you so much for joining us.
No, like I said, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you both.
Absolutely. So, in Richards, until next time, we will see you on the Health and Wealth Podcast. Thank you, everybody. Hey, and Richards, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Health and Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Carter Wilcoxon.
And I'm your host, Tim James. And by God, we are committed to helping you guys have fat wallets, flat bellies. So tune in again for another episode and make sure to like, share, and drink a lot of water.
Or beer.
You have just listened to the Health and Wealth Podcast with Carter and Tim.